In our previous talk on Old Testament archaeology, we saw that the evidence more often illuminates the biblical story than confirms it. And not to say that the Bible is disproven by archaeology, but sometimes it forces us to rethink. Let me give you just two Old Testament examples before we talk about manuscript evidence and then talk about New Testament artifacts. The first Old Testament example would be the flood. Now, there's no shortage of flood literature. Sometimes it's connected with young earth creationist literature that wants to prove to us that there was a universal cataclysm, and there's evidence of this in the whole world for one flood. It took place at one time, wiping out mankind. Is there evidence when it comes to geology or archaeology? Do we see the evidence of ancient civilizations being destroyed in one global deluge? To be truthful, no, we don't. There's certainly evidence of floods worldwide, but almost all of these flood stories come from coastal regions, or they are alluvial. That is, they are in connection with rivers that periodically overflow. For example, the Nile. So there are lots of flood stories. And if you want to find evidence of flooding, geologically, there's no shortage of it. But it comes from multiple times, many different times. So I'm not trying to argue for a global flood or local flood. That's not my purpose. Only to say that if we're honest, we cannot, at least currently, show any strong evidence that there was a global flood. That's not proven by the evidence. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. But we must be careful not to stretch. Here's another example. Conservative Bible scholars, those who believe in its inspiration and really look to it as the Word of God, used to hold 1446 BC as the date of the Exodus. And that was arrived at by taking 1 Kings 6:1 in a very literal way. Because that gives us a date for Solomon's temple, and it gives us a certain number of years, 480, and it's really just a matter of adding years, and you come to an exact date in the 15th century BC for the evidence, for the Exodus. And that's the date I held to until I started equivocating maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and probably the last 6-7 years I've given it up. I just don't think it's sustainable. The archaeological evidence for a 15th century Exodus is very weak. And it's not just the Exodus, really it's the conquest. It's the other part of it. So the Jews leave Egypt, but then they go into the promised land. And there should be at least some evidence of the Canaanites being eradicated, displaced, or cities burned, and so forth. There's really not much to say about the 15th century, but there's plenty of evidence for the 13th century. And since many Bible scholars have a different way of looking at 1 Kings 6:1, basically looking at its 12 generations rather than 480 literal years, the more solid date based on archaeology works out just fine. At any rate, archaeology sometimes makes us reconsider, but I don't expect it's ever going to refute our biblical faith. We ended up the Old Testament lesson with the shameful admission that idolatry was rampant in Israel in every stage of its history, even when Israel knew better, even when they had the law, and especially when they had the prophets telling them to go back. Let me share something that I think is a little bit more encouraging, because we ended on the note of idolatry, and that's the manuscript evidence, and particularly the Dead Sea Scrolls. Whether it comes to the Hebrew and Aramaic Old Testament or the Greek New Testament, the originals are apparently long lost. The truth is, an original could be discovered if we would recognize it as an original, but I don't think that's likely to happen. Let me give you a couple reasons why. And this would apply to New Testament manuscripts and Old Testament manuscripts. One is simply the passage of time. Things deteriorate, especially where there's any moisture. It's not a coincidence that most of the manuscript finds have been found in very dry locations, like the caves around the Dead Sea or parts of Egypt. Moisture is the enemy of the manuscript. We also know that when manuscripts were so worn that they were no longer usable, they were given a proper burial. That's not so helpful if you want things to be preserved, because again, moisture can get there. Later, in the times of the Roman persecutions, and I'm referring to the 2nd, 3rd, and early 4th centuries AD, Bibles were confiscated and burned. And so there are a couple of reasons manuscripts wouldn't survive. Sometimes they were intentionally destroyed. Other times, they simply became a victim of the elements, particularly moisture, water. But let me tell you another reason that ancient manuscripts didn't normally make it. And you have to go no farther than your own bookshelf in your search. Now, I realize this may not be totally applicable if you use digital Bibles. And right now, I probably use digital Bibles 90% of the time. But I'm recording this in my office, looking out at the... It's a beautiful May day here in the Atlanta area. It's green. It's beautiful. I look on my shelf and I've got dozens and dozens of Bibles over there in many languages. Now, if you look at the older ones, you can see that they were getting worn out. We have a great luxury in English with more than 100 translations available just in English. And with the relatively low price of books, we have the ability to buy us a new Bible if we need. But what happens when it really gets worn out? Well, I never really wanted to cross that bridge. When my Bibles would get worn, I would typically give them away to someone else. Hey, you want my Bible? But when you read the Bible a lot, it wears out. And this is one test of someone who's just a Sunday Christian, particularly if he only has one Bible. Say, can I see your Bible? And when you see the pages still stuck together, where it's clear he's never read the Old Testament or only parts of the New, I can tell you that that Bible will probably last a long time. The more faithful the reader, the less long it will last. And so we give some credit to the ancient Christians and the ancient Jews for wearing out their manuscripts. Does that make sense? I hope it does. Now, when we talk about the preservation of these manuscripts, this is a different issue from the matter of the truth of the manuscripts. Even if the message was preserved perfectly, that would not prove that the message was true. Similarly, if you found, the oldest Qurans, the Muslim scripture, the Qurans, are from, maybe around 800 AD. Even if you found a copy of the Quran from the very late 600s, just a few decades after Muhammad, even if it corresponded well to modern Qurans, and there were many versions, by the way, but even if it did, that wouldn't prove the Quran was true. It would just prove that, in at least one case, it was well copied. Does that make sense? So I'm not saying that the preservation of the Bible proves its inspiration, but it's very useful for you as a student of Christian evidences to know about this, because so many people say the Bible has been changed. There's a conspiracy. You can't trust it. It's a translation of a translation, which, by the way, is virtually never true. Modern versions are made from the oldest available manuscripts. They make them from the Greek and the Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek. And they don't make it from, you don't make a modern English version from an old English version, which came from a middle French, from a high German. It's not the way it works. They use the oldest manuscripts possible, and so many have survived. And part of my, I guess on the side, because I love languages so much, I've had a chance to spend a lot of time copying Greek manuscripts, visiting museums and universities, and in many cases holding in my hand precious manuscripts of the New Testament especially, but even the Old Testament in Greek and Latin. And if you live in the United States, and I'm sure many of you listening to this are in that position, but even many Europeans would also be able to do this, you can visit a New Testament manuscript. And there's a page or two in my book, Compelling Evidence, that tells you where your nearest manuscript is. Okay, so these manuscripts tend to wear out. Even though we know the Jews were careful, at least later on, the professionals were trained. People like Ezra, perhaps, the scribe, Ezra 7, verse 6. People who had a great reverence for God's Word. But even though The copyists may have been careful. They were writing on perishable materials. So when are the oldest surviving Old Testament? Let's talk about Old and then New. And then we'll get into the New Testament archaeological evidence. For the Old Testament, the oldest surviving manuscripts come from around 800 AD, or maybe 1000 AD. No, you didn't mishear me. I was telling you what was true until about 60 years ago. Because when my parents were born, the oldest surviving Old Testaments were from over 1,000 years after the Old Testament was written. In other words, they were from the Middle Ages and generally from the High Middle Ages. That was the case until 1947. At this time, Muhammad Ithdib, Muhammad the Wolf, he was a goat herd, a Bedouin boy, he was born in 1931, teenager, accidentally discovered what turned out to be the Dead Sea Scrolls. I would love to tell you the whole story of it, but I've recounted that in the book Compelling Evidence. The scrolls came through him to the Kondo family, and through Kondo, they came to the attention of the academic community, and now they are priceless wonders. My wife met the Kondo family, that is, the patriarch of which bought those original Dead Sea Scrolls from Muhammad the Wolf, and that's enabled me to build something of a relationship with them, and it's made me even more interested in these ancient documents. The Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, are found at Qumran on the Dead Sea. They were found in jars. Some jars had shattered, probably most had, but some were in jars, some were simply under bat guana. But if you look in Jeremiah 32:14, you'll see that it was common for things to be in jars. And the point is this. Some of these scrolls were biblical manuscripts, and some of those biblical manuscripts were ancient. Not Middle Ages, because the community was abandoned in 68 AD. In other words, the newest scrolls there were no younger than 68 AD. But most of those Old Testament scrolls are from before the time of Christ, which pushes back the date about 1,000 years. So instead of the great codex, the Aleppo Codex or Leningrad Codex, which are from around 800 or 1,000 AD, now there are manuscripts that survive from 200 BC, or the famous Isaiah scroll from 150 BC. This is amazing stuff. And so the significance is that since the Dead Sea Scrolls closely match the medieval manuscripts, oh, there's some small changes, but nothing of content, nothing of significance. Because they match, then presumably we can trust the copying process. And so those Dead Sea Scrolls are the best evidence we have that the Old Testament has been well preserved. Well, if it's true of the Old Testament, it's even more true of the New Testament. Because the New Testament was written so much later. And these Greek manuscripts have survived in the thousands. The key date, when we think of New Testament manuscripts, a key date would fall in the 1400s. Because in the 1450s, you have the printing press. And before that time, everything, not just Bibles, but any work had to be copied by hand. In other words, they were manuscripts from the Latin word manus for hand, scriptum, written. They were handwritten. Now, once the advent of printing, then the difficulty and the expense of producing manuscripts has gone totally. So when we talk about the number of manuscripts that have survived of the New Testament, when you hear that mentioned, people are talking about from the beginning, that is the first century, up until the 15th century, the 1400s, when printing, the printing press was invented in Europe. And the number of Greek manuscripts is well over 5,000. The number of Latin manuscripts is about 10,000. But there are many others in secondary, tertiary, quaternary languages. And so the grand total is something like 25,000 or so. But not to throw people off. Some of these are complete New Testaments, but not many. Most of them are more likely to be complete books of the New Testament, but to be really honest with you, most of them are just partial books. Today, the oldest surviving manuscript of the New Testament, and as of today, and I'm speaking to you in May 2012, is Papyrus 52, which contains parts of John 18. P52 is in the University Library in Manchester, in England. I had the privilege of a private viewing, and they even let me hold it in my hand back in 1995. It may have to give way to an even older manuscript. Just this year, every year more and more manuscripts are discovered, and it's not totally clear yet, but some of these may be the oldest copies of Paul's letters. Well, up to now, the oldest letters of Paul, you find them in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and in Dublin, in Ireland. And they're from maybe the very late 2nd century. And if you ever go to Dublin, you should visit the Chester Beatty Library. But they found some manuscripts of the Pauline literature that seem to be older. And so far, there's no 1st century manuscript, but everyone's always hoping. I saw one in Oxford that some people thought was 1st century. I'm pretty skeptical. But there's another one that's come out, supposedly part of Mark. We'll find out. You know, eventually it's quite possible because Christians were avid in sharing their faith and in copying those manuscripts because they were very valuable. Well, manuscript evidence is not, properly speaking, part of archaeology, but it is an important part of evidence. And I hope you'll find the chapters in the book, Compelling Evidence, on the biblical manuscripts to be useful to you and give you material that you can share with your friends. The New Testament manuscript evidence is absolutely superb. There are about 100 papyruses. There are about 300 manuscripts that are written all in capital letters called uncials. There are nearly 3,000 minuscules. These are written on small letters, Greek script. There are readings, standardized readings for every day of the church calendar. These are called lectionaries. There are about 2,300 of those. And these are all in Greek, and that adds up to about 5,500. And as I mentioned, there are about 25,000 in all. But the earlier you go, the fewer you find. Currently, nothing in the 1st century, unless this new discovery is verified. 2nd century, there are a handful, but not many. And what has survived is very fragmentary. 3rd century, quite a bit more. 4th century, now you're finding lots of complete books, and 5th century and so forth. At any rate, we saw how well the Old Testament scribes did, and we have great reason to believe that just as they kept the word preserved for that 1,000-year gap between the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the High Middle Ages, in the same way in the New Testament copying, we can trust that the scribes took great care and took no liberties at all. And one other thing I just throw in here for you. The words of the Buddha weren't written down for about 500 years after his lifetime. The ancient Hindu writings were written down. You know, this is before the time of Christ, but the earliest surviving manuscripts are from way in the time of Christ. I've seen the oldest surviving Buddhist manuscripts, and they're about 1,300 years after the time of the Buddha. Now, maybe more will be discovered, and maybe I've missed something. It was on one of my trips to Japan. I went to the ancient capital of Nara, and I was eager to see these manuscripts from the 8th century AD. In the case of Hinduism, the earliest surviving manuscript is around 1300 AD. Even though these things were written down before the time of Christ, the manuscripts don't survive. How about Christianity? Well, the oldest surviving manuscripts, if we take P52, that part of John's Gospel from the early 2nd century, if John was written around the year 90, and that manuscript is from the year perhaps 120, then we have a manuscript surviving that's only 30 years after the original. That is incredible. That's incredible. You find nothing like that in the other religions of the world. And that's why F.F. Bruce, the scholar of exegesis in Manchester said, there is no body of ancient literature in the world which enjoys such a wealth of good textual attestation as the New Testament. And you can trust in that. I trust in that with all my heart. And I know there are lots of skeptics who think that the fact that the manuscripts disagree disproves them. I don't think anything of the kind. And I think, let me give a word of advice to you. As you share your faith, I think you can speak with great confidence that the New Testament has been well copied. There's plenty of evidence in that area. But don't say our modern New Testaments are identical to the original. Or don't say that the copyists never made mistakes, because they did. Don't say that if you prove to me that even one word has been changed, I'll give up my Christian faith, because that would not be a very intelligent position. Why would we need to believe that no word could change? The point surely is not that no words changed. It's that nothing was added to the word. That is the message. Nothing was taken away. We're not talking about spelling mistakes or saying Christ Jesus instead of Jesus Christ. That was a very common copying error. We're talking about the message itself. And I think we tend to overclaim. We overreach. And we say, well, it's perfect. And if there's anything that was wrong, then I'll give up my faith. Don't say that. Why can't there be some small errors? That would not prove that the Bible's not inspired. The point is the truth content of the message. And if that has been preserved, then we have our case. That's all we need. Well, I'd like to talk about some of the hard evidence. Now, I'm not talking about manuscripts. Let's talk about New Testament artifacts. And there are so many exciting ones I would love to tell you about. I think of Caesarea Philippi, where Peter confessed to Jesus' identity. I know the archaeologist who worked there for years and found so many incredible things. I think there's really no better way for you to become intimate with the evidence than to read a couple books and then go to Israel. That's my advice. If you've never done it, aim to do that before you're too old to walk well and climb and go in those ruins. But please go there. There have been extensive excavations at that Caesarea, the other Caesarea, which is Caesarea Maritima, where Pontius Pilate was headquartered, Capernaum, where Jesus lived, his second home after Nazareth, Bethsaida, Bethshan, which is also called Scythopolis. That was the capital of the Decapolis. And I think Bethshan is probably the most extensive archaeological site in Israel, and in some ways more impressive than anything in Jerusalem. Not to say that the ruins of the Temple Mount and Hezekiah's Tunnel and so forth aren't interesting. I mean, you know, going into the Garden of Gethsemane, that's a fun thing to do. But Bethshan is the most extensive. Ephesus is amazing. In the western side of Turkey, province of Asia, in old Asia Minor, probably the most impressive of all ancient ruins in the world. I've never been anywhere that's more impressive than Ephesus. Not Rome, not Athens, nowhere. There's so many things I'd love to share with you. Let me give you some specific examples. One, again, illustrating the point that archaeology illuminates more than confirms. The first time I ever went to Israel, I left my quarters the next morning. I had just come in from, I guess I was living in Washington at the time, so it had been a bit of a long flight. I went for a walk, and I stumbled into a garden. And I found a first century tomb. And sometimes when I share this with audiences around the world, they give me this almost superhuman credence. Like, you what? You discovered a first century tomb? No. It's there. I mean, it's, you know, it says it on there's a plaque as you go into the garden. You know, first century tomb of the Herods. It's the royal family of Herod. So the significance is not that you're going to discover it, but in a way you do. You discover it for yourself, because this tomb was made from rock. It had a stone in front of the entrance, and the stone was round. Oh, that doesn't really prove that Jesus rose from the dead. No, not at all. But I've seen several first century tombs. They all look like the tomb described in the Gospels. And as for the stone being round, it's not spherical. it's more like a disc. It's not like a boulder, it's more like a frisbee. And it locks in place as it rolls downhill in a groove and difficult to open but easy to close. And when I saw that, a light went off in my head. And the light wasn't, Jesus truly rose from the dead. The light was, that's what they meant in biblical times. And so for me, and I think you may be like me, when you can envision what this looked like, it's easier to think it through. And eventually, that actually does make it easier to have faith. I'll tell you something else I like in Israel. When you go to the Sea of Galilee, by the way, you'll be impressed how small it is. And also, of course, it's fresh water. But you go to the Sea of Galilee, and I think you will be very impressed when you see the weather. If you go on the sea and the wind whips up and you see the waves, that'll bring back in your memory certain Bible passages. But on the at the edge of the sea, in a little town, Gennesar, there is a boat. In the mid-80s, the water level, you know, water is always a big issue in the Middle East. The water level went quite low, and something was sticking out of the mud at the edge of the sea. And it was really the shell of a boat, a fishing boat, carbon dated to about the time of Jesus. What do they call this boat? Well, of course, they call it the Jesus boat, because then you get publicity and you get tourists coming. And they carefully moved it, preserved it, and built a museum around it. Now, could this have been the boat Jesus was in? It could be a boat that Jesus or some of his fishermen apostles was in. Of course, it could be. But that's not the point. The point is, that's what a fishing boat looked like. Oh, yeah, you could get quite a few men in there. Okay, now I'm seeing it's real. It has the ring of truth. When Bethsaida was identified, which was only around the year 1990, it took forever because it's a fishing village. It's just not that close to the Sea of Galilee. It's a long walk. They found fish hooks in the foundations of some of the homes. Fish hooks. Oh. See, when you can, the nets would have rotted, but when you see fish hooks, fishing boats, the culture is coming to life, the Bible is coming to life. Sea of Galilee. We have the town of Capernaum. Capernaum. Capernaum is the village of Nahum, the prophet. Capernaum was Jesus' second home. And there's so much there. My favorite spot is the synagogue. Now, if you look at the synagogue, you would recognize the style as being Byzantine, that is, you know, 4th century or later. But it's built on the foundation of the 1st century synagogue. And so you know that while some of the stones you're looking at are more modern, you're in the exact location of the synagogue where Jesus walked. And the way they recycle stones anyway, some of the stones were probably the originals anyway. What strikes me about the Capernaum Synagogue is how large it is. But on the other hand, it makes me think that he couldn't speak to the largest possible crowds inside a synagogue. Let me explain what I mean. You have a passage like Luke 12, 1, where the crowds are trampling each other, crowds of many thousands. That kind of crowd wouldn't fit in the synagogue. The synagogue could take a couple hundred, maybe a few hundred. In John 6, when Jesus says, he turns up the heat, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood, you need to be fully committed to me, and they start abandoning him in droves. And then Jesus turns to Peter and the apostles, the 12, what are you going to do? Are you going to leave too? And they say, we can't leave. We know who you are. You have the words of eternal life. And at the end of John 6, it says, this was taking place in the synagogue in Capernaum. Ah, the first time I went to that synagogue, then I had a fact in my head and a memory, which meant the next time I read John 6, that image came up automatically on the blank, otherwise blank screen of my mind. It lights up. And I realized, okay, a lot of people left him, but if it was in the synagogue, there were probably only a few hundred people to start with, because I had always imagined it was thousands of people walking away. Well, so archaeology kind of gives me a good control. Right across the street from the synagogue is a first century house. All that survived are the foundations. It's quite a large house. They call it Peter's house, or St. Peter's house. Why do they call it that? Well, you know, it could be. Okay, I'm the skeptic. I don't think so. But it could be, because it's unusual for the memory of things to survive unless they're important. It is in the town that Peter lived in. I mean, he did live there at some point. And it's a large house. It's a significant structure. It's possible. And even if it's not Peter's house, it's right across the way from the synagogue. What does that mean? Well, if Capernaum is this town where Jesus lived, and Jesus was as sociable as he seems to be in the Gospels, there's strong reason to believe that he had visited this house. And so when you're there, you're in a place where Jesus was. I mentioned the nearby city of Bethsaida, which had been excavated, but not fully and not identified as Bethsaida until 1989. Isn't that amazing? The Pool of Siloam. Think of John 9 when Jesus heals the blind man. That was discovered only in 2004. 2004. So recently. One of my favorite places in Jerusalem has to be the Garden of Gethsemane. And there are some trees in there that are close to 1,000 years old. They may be scions of trees from the first century, for all we know. When the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70, it says that they cut down the trees. It doesn't mean they got every stump necessarily, but there's certainly a continuity. When you're in the Garden of Gethsemane and you can book it, if you make an arrangement with the gardener, you can book it for private functions or for prayer. It's a wonderful place to be. And again, this doesn't prove that Jesus was arrested, but you can see the kind of place. You can see why he would go to a place like that to pray and why they call it Gethsemane, because that's from the Aramaic for olive press. And if you go into the cave underneath the garden, you'll see the evidence that there used to be an olive press there. Interesting stuff. Pontius Pilate happened to be in Jerusalem when Jesus was killed, but normally he was in the north on the Mediterranean port of Caesarea Maritima. Maritime Caesarea. Pontius Pilate was the governor or prefect from 26 to 36 AD. He was known for literature, but the first hard evidence, archaeologically, was found in 1961. I was just a young boy. I mean, this was in my lifetime. Maybe some of you listening to this as well. And it was a stone that had been reused. Again, the ancients would reuse stones. And it had become part of the theater. But originally, it was a dedication stone. It was from a building dedicated to the emperor Tiberius. Well, Tiberius was emperor from 14 to 37. And it mentions him, it mentions the governor or prefect, Pontius Pilatus, and it calls him Praefectus, which is his actual role. And it says he's the prefect of Judea. And that's right, because later it became the province of Syria, but at that time it's Judea. I mean, it's perfect. It confirms Luke. It confirms what we read about in the Bible. It shows that Pontius Pilate was a real person. Archaeological evidence. What is most significant to me is that it was discovered so recently. Last time I was in the Israel Museum, I saw the Pilate stone right next to another archaeological treasure. A real treasure, the Caiaphas ossuary. Now, remember Caiaphas was the high priest, and the whole institution had become pretty corrupt by the first century, because they were supposed to serve for life, but when you read the Gospel of John, you know, it says, the high priest this year was this guy. You know, they seem to have been appointed, and it was very politicized, very much in cahoots with the government. Well, workers on the Mount of Olives, where everyone wants to be buried because Jews and Muslims believe the last resurrection will start right there. Read the book of Zechariah. Workers were digging around and they discovered an underground chamber with a number of ossuaries. An ossuary is a bone box. And this secondary burial was practiced only for about a century. And it was practiced in most of the first century. After the flesh had fallen off the bones and the soft organs had decomposed, usually it'd be about a year and a half later, maybe a little bit more, maybe 2 years, but in that 1 to 2 year range, the family would come and take the bones and repackage them in a much smaller, in a small box. And the only requirement really is that the long bone of the leg, the femur, would be able to fit as the hypotenuse of the, you know, the triangle that you would create from making a, running a diagonal from one corner to the opposite corner of the box, if that makes sense. So ossuaries, or bone boxes, are not normally labeled, and they're pretty simple, but when this was found, they found something that was highly ornate, clearly belonged to a rich man. I've seen the ossuary a number of times. It's very impressive, and it actually has the name of the guy on the side. Back then, they normally just scratched on the name if they put the name on at all. But this is amazing. It has his name, which is Caiaphas. His name is Joseph Caiaphas, and he's identified as the priest. He's the high priest. And we have an insight into how people lived. In fact, if you go into Jerusalem, this is outside of the city and the Israel Museum. But if you go into Jerusalem, one of the best museums is called the Burnt House Museum. The Burnt House Museum. It belonged to a family, a very wealthy family. And you see the house pretty much as it was when it was destroyed in the fire in 70 AD when the Romans came. And this belonged to a priestly family. I was stunned the first time I was there at how big it was, and whatever the weather outside, how cool it was. The cool stone building would be very pleasant, even in the summer. Well, Jerusalem's about half a mile above sea level, so that helps too. But these people were rich. And this agrees with the picture we see in the New Testament, that the priesthood had become politicized, that the high priesthood was corrupt. They were very closely allied to the Sadducees, and it was all about money. And it makes me think of big money today that we see, sadly, in some so-called representatives of Christianity. Well, how about that? In this bone box, they find skeletons. Actually, I think in the dig, they found six different skeletons. But in that box, there were the bones of a man in his 60s. And almost certainly, these are the bones of Yosef Bar Caiapha, Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest, the one who engineered the crucifixion of Jesus. Well, a few years ago, the bone box of James, the brother of Jesus, was discovered. It's still controversial. I talked to experts who think that it's fake. Those who are best qualified all think it's genuine. Maybe we'll never know. But there are these ossuaries, these bone boxes, really get us thinking about the New Testament. I mentioned that the Pilate stone was right next to the Caiaphas ossuary. There are actually three exhibits all together in the Israel Museum. And the third is the foot of a crucified man, Yohanan. John is his name, Yohanan ben Hagagol. He was crucified sometime, it was in the first century. He was in his 20s, perhaps 26, 27. He, just as the crucifixion is described in the Bible, crucifixion of Jesus, that's the way they crucified him. And he's, amazingly, this is the first physical evidence of crucifixion. Now, we know that when the Pharisees revolted, before the time of Christ, there were many of them crucified. I think it was like 900. Is that what Josephus says? We know that when Spartacus led the slave revolt, thousands of slaves were crucified along the Appian Way, you know, that main highway going out of Rome. But no physical evidence of a crucified man had been found until 1968. Wow, this is recent, when they find the foot of a crucified man. And when the nail had gone through his foot, it must have hit a knot in the wood or something, and the nail ended up curving, and they couldn't get his foot off, so they just took the nail with it. I guess they probably had to cut part of the cross. It would have been messy, whatever they did. But the foot of a crucified man, is that interesting to you? To me, that's really interesting stuff. Just in 2011, the tomb of Philip, the Apostle Philip, was identified in Hierapolis in western Turkey. I was in the city of David last year. I was talking to an archaeologist, and I said, what's new? This guy is a rabbi and an archaeologist, good combination. And he said, well, one of our people found a little bell in the sewer. into the drains under the old city of David, which is being excavated right now. Well, what kind of bell? I'm wondering, you mean like a bell, like the high priest's garment? He said, yes, it's golden, it's ornate, and when we picked it up, it rang. It rings. It's very small, but it does make you wonder. Now, this is not proof that it's the high priest's bell, but it's suggestive, and it's certainly illustrative. This is the kind of thing. It has a little hole so you can put thread through and put it on a garment. It clearly was on a garment. It could very well have been a bell from the high priest's garment, maybe even from Caiaphas's garment. How about that? Oh, there are so many more things I'd like to tell you. Let me just mention a couple. The Soreg inscription. You'll remember the animosity, the antipathy between Jews and Gentiles, especially on the part of Jews, we see in the New Testament. And non-Jews were only allowed just so far. The Jews had put lots of divisions. According to the law, you had to be a priest to come to the holy place and the high priest to the most holy place. But the Jews had the court of the Israelites, the court of the women, the court of the Gentiles. And so Gentiles had to really keep their distance. And there are these warning signs around. And a couple of these actual warnings from the temple itself have been found. And they read something like this. No foreigner is to go beyond the balustrade. Now, foreigner means a Gentile, not a Jew. He's not to go beyond the balustrade, this kind of low fence, and the plaza of the temple zone. Whoever is caught doing so will have himself to blame for his ensuing death. Well, that's the background of the riot. Remember in Jerusalem, some people thought that Paul had brought Titus into the sanctuary? You know, he brought a Gentile up there? That makes sense. And speaking of Titus, but this is a different Titus, one of my favorite New Testament artifacts, if I can call it that, is in Rome. Jesus prophesied in Matthew 24 that the city and the temple would be destroyed. And indeed, that happened. And the culmination of the Jewish war, first Jewish war, first Roman war, in 66 AD to 73. And Jerusalem was destroyed in 70. The emperor Vespasian began the work, but he wasn't emperor yet. He was called back to Rome. And then his son Titus took over. And Titus became emperor after Vespasian. So Titus completed the destruction. And he built, at the end of the Roman Forum, the Arch of Titus. Have you seen that in the Forum? Or maybe just Google it and take a peek. The Arch of Titus has pictures of the Jewish slaves coming back. It even has the menorah, the seven-branch candlestick. And more than 1 million people, according to Josephus, were enslaved and crucified. The Jews were punished in this terrible war. And that slave labor built the Colosseum, which was completed 10 years later in the year 80 AD. And so the Jewish slaves built the Roman Colosseum. And the Romans were so proud of this military victory, more coins commemorating the defeat of the Jews in 70 AD were struck, or at least have survived, than any other Roman victory that's been commemorated. Amazing stuff. Okay, I have time for just a couple more. Herod the Great, 4 BC is when he died. He tried to kill Jesus when Jesus was a baby. In 2008, his tomb was identified. Notice how recent that is. I have so many other things I could share with you. Usually when I teach archaeology, we have a question time, and then all kinds of things come up, which is a real blast. But we need to bring this lesson to a completion. So what will I say? A lot of the lessons are the same as we see for the Old Testament. You know, it whets our appetite. It illuminates more than it confirms. Some 27 people named in the New Testament are known from other records. 6 likenesses survive. 4 of them are Roman emperors. Over 50 persons named in the Old Testament are known outside the Bible. And we have pictures, likenesses of 12 of them, like Jehu, son of Nimshi. So when we're talking about biblical archaeology, we don't have to confine ourselves just to Israel or just to places where Jesus or the apostles were, because it crosses over and we find stuff around the Mediterranean. And I know I said I would. I got to throw in this one more. It's got to be one of my all-time favorites. On the Palatine Hill in Rome, in 1856, there was a discovery of a graffito. And this graffito, I believe it was in a military quarters, and it's scratched into the plaster, Alexamenos worshiping his god. Alexamenos was the man's name. And there's an image of a donkey, a jackass, on top, on a cross. And it says, Alexamenos worshiping his god. And this is dated to approximately 200 AD. So as far away as Rome, we see people mocking Christianity. I guess the implication is if you worship a jackass, you are one. But it's clearly Christ on a cross. And he's worshiped as God. He was worshiped as God from the very beginning. So all over the ancient world, there are great things waiting to be discovered, not just in Israel, but in Italy and Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Syria, Jordan. I mean, it's amazing. And some of us say, yes, let's go get them, boys. Let's find more. But that's difficult because people have built homes and villages and cities over these ruins. You can't just tell people, please vacate. We want to dig in case we find an ancient lamp or a coin underneath your foundation. You know, people don't take very kindly to that. So I think discoveries will keep coming to light slowly but surely. It is happening. A large number of discoveries of New Testament archaeology have been made only in recent decades, and that suggests to me there's probably much more to be found. Let's use this information not just to be excited in our minds intellectually, but remember, the true goal of following God is transformation. And if we can use this information to strengthen our faith and to help someone else's faith, help someone else to know Christ, then I think we're really using it as we should.